I have here a book by an Australian author called John Dixon. It's been around a wee while, and it says, "If I were God, I'd make myself clearer." And I wonder if you've ever thought something like that. He begins by writing about a teacher whom he knows, who teaches in a private school. And this teacher begins every morning, or most mornings at least, with 10 minutes of transcendental meditation, a few lines from the Quran, and a rendition of the Lord's Prayer. And maybe that's the case of trying to cover all your bets, a kind of religious insurance or something. And then he goes on to say about a number of his mates who do virtually nothing of a spiritual nature at all. No church, no prayers, and no experiences of an ecstatic nature, except perhaps for a few rugby matches. And if you were at the Aviva last night, then I guess you'll know what that's like. But for a lot of people, that's it. I mean, that is the height of that's the most religious they will get, is maybe the way they treat sport or something. And John Dixon writes in this book, he says that really both approaches, the pick and mix religious practices, and also those who do virtually nothing of a spiritual nature, they're often just different responses to the one spiritual dilemma that many people feel. And that is that when it comes to faith, many people feel that we simply cannot be too dogmatic about anything. You know, we really can't know for sure about anything when it comes to God. And because, hey, there are so many competing claims. And how can we know what to believe? Sure, we can only guess about God. And maybe that's how you feel about Christianity. There are things, perhaps, that you find good and quite compelling, maybe, about the Christian faith. But at the end of the day, maybe for you it's just a case of personal preferences, you know? Because we don't really know. You know, each of us is simply left to whatever we're drawn to most. And whatever you think has the most truth or value in it, that's what you'll adopt in some measure. But not, you know, not being too extreme or too overly committed, because, you know, we really can't be too sure about God and about spirituality. We're each on a journey and we each have to find our own way. I think that's how a lot of people think, and it is one reason why we have to read the Gospel of John. Because into this confusion, John writes, and in some ways it's like a cup of cold water in the face, because it just confronts us, and it's like a, you know, it should wake us up and bring us clarity in a world full of so much confusion. John is emphatic that we absolutely can know God, because contrary to the title of this little book, God has made himself clear. And actually, it's a good little book. The author does think that God has made himself clear, despite the title. We see this in the Gospel of John, that God has revealed himself to us in the most extraordinary way. Not just by speaking to us from afar, like with a big tannoy in the sky, and not even just by coming down and doing some powerful things among us by his Spirit. What these verses in the prologue of John's Gospel say is something so much more profound, so much more staggering, because we're introduced to a person whom John calls the Word, chapter 1, verse 1. He's called the Word because he is God's self-expression. He is the revelation of who God is. And according to verse 1, this person called the Word was God. And yet, according to verse 14, the Word became flesh. So this person called the Word, he was God, and yet he actually became a human being without ceasing to be God. And he's talking, of course, about Jesus Christ, whom he names in verse 17, and who is the subject and the focus of the entire Gospel of John, and indeed the whole Bible. And the point is that when we get to know Jesus in the Gospels, we get to know God. Truly know God, without speculation or guessing. When I was in India recently, I'm recently back from a trip to India, and when I was away, I was there with a colleague who's a minister in Bangor up north, and his name is David Johnson. He was telling me a story about the time when he was on holiday in France, and he saw a friend walking past. I think he was on a campsite, and he saw a friend going by, and yet he just wasn't 100% sure. He was pretty sure, but he wasn't totally sure, and he thought, yeah, that has to be Jim. Like, that was Jim, wasn't it? And he said to his wife, look, there's Jim, isn't it? And he kept on seeing this guy over the next few days, and he thought, yep, that's got to be Jim. I'm gonna go talk to him. It'd be good to catch up with him. And so he caught up with Jim, who, of course, had never seen David before in his life and spoke only French. When it comes to knowing God, we're not left with mere hunches or guesses or some revelation that is merely close to what God is like. The revelation of God that we get in Jesus Christ is no mere resemblance of the divine. Jesus is, in himself, the very incarnation of God, so that we can know God and have life in his name. That's why John writes, if we were to look forward in chapter 20, you don't need to look it up, but chapter 20, verse 31, John explains why he's writing this gospel, and he says, these signs are written, and he's got seven signs in particular, seven miracles of Jesus through this gospel, and in a way, they're, you know, John is piling up the evidence for who Jesus is. And he says, I'm writing this so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And you see, the Greeks, you know, at this time of writing, they thought that life was all about philosophical contemplation of the moral order in the universe. And they called that the Word or the Logos. And they thought that life was about living according to this this order of nature. But here's John, and John's saying, no. Life is not about knowing some abstract rational structure in the universe, but rather about knowing a person. A person who walked this earth and died on the cross and rose again. His name is Jesus. He is the Word, the Logos, the one behind everything, and he is God's Word to us. And so, what the point of that, our three main points, the point is that we must bow to him, we must believe in him, and we must receive from him. Bow, believe, and receive. That's the basic structure of this prologue. We bow to him because of the description of the Word in verses 1 to 5. We believe in him because of the witness to the Word of John the Baptist in history, verses 6 to 8. Not to mention all the other evidence provided in this gospel. We've reason to believe in him. And then we receive from him the benefits of the Word to those who believe in verses 9 to 13. And that structure is then repeated. We bow to him because of yet another description of the Word in verse 14. We believe in him because once again we have the witness to the Word of John the Baptist in history, verse 15. And we receive from him the benefits of the Word to those who believe, highlighted again in verses 16 to 18. So bow, believe, receive. Why should anyone bow to Jesus? Let me rephrase that. Why should everyone bow to Jesus? Here are five reasons in the description of the Word in verses 1 to 5. First of all, he is eternal. In the beginning was the Word, chapter 1, verse 1. That deliberately echoes the creation of the world told in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Before there was anything created, there was the Word, not made. Not bound by time and space. You cannot go back to a time before the Word. There was no before the Word. There was always the Word. He is eternal. The universe, on the other hand, had a beginning. We know that scientifically. The universe we live in does not have an eternal past. But this person called the Word does. Second, he is relational. Again, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. We see here that this person is distinct from God the Father, and yet one with him. Verse 14 says that he came from the Father, And verse 18 says that he is at the Father's side. So he's clearly not the Father. He is distinct from God the Father. Not to be confused with God the Father. And yet not to be separated either. He is eternally with the Father. That speaks of intimate communion and an intimate love that is vitally important in our understanding of God. Because God is not a mere isolated substance or force. God is love. And that's why relationships matter to you and me. That's why we care so much about relationships. Because we're not made to be alone. But we're made to be with others in relationship. And that's because we're made in God's image. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. Third, as we've seen, the Word is God. He is eternal, he is relational, and he is God. He's not part God. He's not like God. He is fully God. The Word was God. Verse 1. Later in the Gospel, if we were to fast forward to chapter 20, we read about one of the disciples called Thomas, He meets the risen Lord Jesus and he falls at Jesus' feet and he says, "My Lord and my God." And that is the staggering claim of Christianity. And it's not just the claim of Christianity or the claim of John. It's, you know, what John writes here is straight from the mouth of Jesus himself. I mean, Jesus accepted the title God from Thomas, because the whole way through his ministry, he claimed to be God. I mean, in chapter 8 of this gospel, Jesus says, "Before Abraham was, I am." And that's not just a claim to be in existence before Abraham. That's an unambiguous claim to be God, because the name of God in the Old Testament is Yahweh, the great I am. So Jesus has taken that name upon his own lips and saying, "It's me. The great I am, the Lord who commanded Abraham to leave his country 2,000 years ago and to go to the land I would show him. I am he. I am the revelation of God, the incarnation of God." And think of the first commandment. I just thought it mentioned the commandments already. The first commandment, "You shall have no other gods before me." And all the commandments are summed up. Jesus says, in loving the Lord our God with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength, loving our neighbor as ourselves. Well, Jesus himself claimed our supreme love. Jesus said that anyone who loved father, mother, son, or daughter more than him was not worthy of him. I mean, that's the claim to be God. If a couple were head over heels in love with each other, Jesus would insist on each of them loving him much, much more than each other, because he is God. And it amazes me that there are so many people who think that Jesus was just a good man, because good men don't claim to be God. And this is the, you know, the classic line from C.S. Lewis, who puts it so well in his book Mere Christianity. He says, "I'm trying to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. They say, 'I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God.'" C.S. Lewis says, "That's the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sorts of things Jesus said would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. Good men don't claim to be God." But Jesus did, because he was God. As John Stott, a preacher in London, the late John Stott, he said, "Jesus made it clear to people that to know him was to know God, to see him was to see God, to believe in him was to believe in God, to receive him was to receive God, to hate him was to hate God, to honor him was to honor God." And therefore, he did not merely invite people to follow him as if they might think it was a good idea. He commanded them to follow him. He commanded complete obedience even to the point of death. Now, I know that might remind you of some crazy cult, you know, like one led by David Koresh in Waco, Texas. It ended horribly in a fire with the death of 76 people in April 1993. But Jesus was not crazy nor cruel. He loved people. He hated people. He cared for people. And he died for people to set them free from sin and death and hell. And he sent his followers into the world to serve people with compassion and with grace. He's worthy. He's worthy of our absolute obedience because, as we were singing, he is the Holy God. He's also creator. He's eternal. He's relational. He's God. He's creator. Through him, all things were made. At verse 3, without him, nothing was made that has been made. Think about this. This is mind-blowing stuff, but we know that Jesus grew up to learn the trade of Joseph, Mary and Joseph, and Joseph was a carpenter. Jesus grew up to learn a carpenter's trade. So picture him as a carpenter for a moment. Picture him with his apron on, designing and cutting and sanding and joining. He's making bits of furniture in a wee village that is just a pinprick on the world that was made through him. And this planet Earth, which has such a place called Nazareth, is just a little dot in the Milky Way galaxy that was made through him. And this galaxy is just a tiny little part of the whole cosmos that was made through him in the very beginning. The one who flung stars into space makes furniture in his own creation. This is Jesus. He shows that he is the creator as well by what he does in this gospel. Think of all the miracles that he does when he's walking around and he's healing the sick and he's feeding the 5,000 and all the miracles he does, he is showing that he is the creator God. One writer says this, Jesus is to us what Shakespeare is to Juliet. And therefore everything about this world and everything about you and everything about your life is grounded in Jesus, through whom you and all things were made. And that makes you and I accountable to him. Belief in Jesus is not just some personal preference. It's what we owe to him as our creator. And this is where people get upset, isn't it? They're like, oh, come on. But this message divides people. We see that it divides people in verses 10 to 12. And we know, don't we? I mean, have you ever had this conversation? Someone will say, I'm happy for you to worship Jesus. I really am. But you have your spirituality, and I have my spirituality, and your way is no better than mine. How do we, what do we say into that, in that kind of a conversation? Of course, we don't want to be obnoxious. We don't want to be rude. But there does come a time, and we have to know the wisdom of God to know when to speak and when to gently try to explain to people. But if we truly care about people, we will surely confront them with the truth that they will have to give account to Jesus someday as their creator. This is not a case of personal preference. The spirituality is not grounded in personal preference. Human accountability is based on the doctrine of creation. We should bow to Jesus. Everyone who has breath should bow to Jesus because he made us and he made all things for himself. We owe him our lives. Fifth, he is the source of all life and light. He is the source of all life and light. Verses 4 and 5, in him was life, and that life was the light of man. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. This is true physically, given that he created life and light in the beginning, but he's also the source of life and light in a deeper way. We're made in his image to know and enjoy him, and therefore we're born with some awareness of his presence, of the reality and power and goodness and majesty and rule of God. And we might suppress that truth and choose the darkness instead, hating the light, not wanting our evil desires to be exposed by him who is the light. But the tragedy is that in rejecting him, we reject true life. And he came into the world to restore us to the life that is in him alone. Bishop J.C. Ryle, whom David Martin mentioned last week from this pulpit, he's long dead now, but J.C. Ryle says, if millions of mankind were mad enough to dwell in caves underground or to bandage their eyes, their darkness would be their own fault. It would not be the fault of the sun. And likewise, he says, if millions of men and women love spiritual darkness rather than light, the blame must be laid on their blind hearts and not on Christ. But whether men will see or not, Christ is the true sun and the light of the world. There is no light for sinners except in the Lord Jesus. You see, we need the life and the light that is in Him alone. And I need so much more time to unpack this. But this is why we must bow to Him. This is why we must know Him and submit to Him. The Word was God. And we believe this not by suspending our brains. I think maybe some people think that. You know, you have to leave your brain at the door when you come to church. But no. Faith, Christian faith, is not some crazy leap in the dark. We can believe in the Word because of the witness to the Word. John the Baptist is mentioned specifically in verses 6 to 8 and again in verse 15. But this just reminds us of the vast amount of evidence not only brought by John the Baptist who witnesses to Jesus, but also the Old Testament, also the apostles, also all the evidence that John records, also everyone who's come to know Jesus, also the whole earth itself. All bear witness to the glory of God in Jesus Christ. We have evidence upon evidence to enable us to believe that He is God. And I just encourage you, I know that this is just a very brief introduction, but read the Gospels. You know, if you're wondering, if you've got questions, and you think, well, I'm not really sure about all this, read the Gospels. To find God, you need to read about Jesus. Not read the stars. Not, you know, look into your inner self. Not just go for a walk in the mountains. That's not how you find God. It's not just by going and spending time in the garden. It's not just by some latest religious craze. You find God by opening the Bible and reading about Jesus. He is God. Just open and read. But the tragedy is, verse 10, He was in the world, and though the world was made through Him, the world did not recognize Him. It's incredible. He came to that which was His own, but His own did not receive Him. But yet, to all who did receive Him, to those who believed in His name, He gave the right to become children of God, children born, not of natural descent, nor of human decision or husband's will, but born of God. We have to receive from Him the benefits of the Word to those who believe. I wish I had more time to talk about these benefits, but to become a child of God is no small thing. We read of how this is a work of God, not a work of human decision, but a work of God to reach into our lives and to transform us, to bring us life that is in Jesus, and to give us blessing upon blessing, verse 16. The law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. We can know Him. We can know His mercy. We can know His forgiveness. We can know His grace because this Word became flesh and hung on a tree so that you and I could be forgiven and could have a relationship with this living God and have life in His name forever and ever. Over these next weeks, we're going to see and unpack His great truths more and more. But may God help us to bow to Him, to believe in Him, and to receive from Him because of who He is.